Yeah, I'm sorry that we had such a short break, but really our schedule is we're supposed to start at 10:30. We're supposed to start this study at 10:30, and we're already about 10 minutes late, and it tends to run on. If this one's late, then the next one's late, and that means we're late getting out. And we've had a pretty good relationship with the union for 9-10 years. That we always pay way in advance. But, however, you have to remember, they're coming here and they're seeing a bunch of vehicles in the parking lot. May 21, Judgment Day. That in itself can stir people up. And so we have to be extra polite, extra gentle and kind with them. And also, we have to follow our part of the bargain, and we have a deal with the union that says we're out of here at 1. So just to keep that in mind. Just keep that in mind. You know, men, when they don't like to hear something, they're going to be looking to see if they can find fault. And then they'll tell themselves, well, you know, even a little thing like being late, they'll say, oh, yeah, these people, you know. And we don't want to do that at all. Okay, at this time we're going to have a question and answer. It's our fellowship time, and each person is invited to raise your hand, whether here or on Pal Talk, and share a question or make a comment. You're welcome to do that. And if you're on Pal Talk, raise your hand, and Bob will relay it to us. And here, please, if you're called upon, come up to the mic. Al.
Now, I've taken several verses and tried to combine them to see if we can expand on your teaching and Brother Camping teaching concerning May 21st, 2011, and see if we can come up with another possible proof that May 21st, 2011 is in fact.
Excuse me a second. Now, I think we wanted to move this over here, didn't we?
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and read this. We're looking at another possible proof that May 21st, 2011 is Judgment Day. I'm going to read through this. As we all know, the flood of Noah Day began 17th day of the month in 4990 B.C. based on the biblical calendar of that day. And May 21st, 2011, Judgment Day, is also the 17th day of the month, 7,000 years after the flood. And this is based on the biblical calendar of our present day. The timing of these two events, separated by 7,000 years, obviously is no accident. We know the spiritual meaning of number 7 is the perfect fulfillment of God's purpose. We also know 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 8 refers to the flood of Noah's day when it says, one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years. And 1,000 years is one day. Now, if you could, Chris, please read Genesis 41:32.
Genesis 41. Excuse me. Okay. Genesis 41 and verse 32 says, "And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass."
Okay. In this verse, we can see that God is laying down a principle that when any event in the Bible is doubled twice, it is established by God and will shortly come to pass. So my question is it possible that God is telling us on this verse as well as the doubling of the flood of Noah's day, the doubling of 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, that May 21st, 2011, is the perfect fulfillment of God's salvation plan, is established by God, and will shortly come to pass.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that is in view. because in 2 Peter 3:8, when God says that one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day, he basically said it twice. He doubled it. And remember also the number of days from the cross up until May 21. What's that number of days? 722,500? Is that right? 722,500 days exactly, well, inclusively, but that's the length of time, and those numbers break down into, I'm going to need your help. I meant to look at the track, and I can't remember. Five times what?
Ten.
Times 17. Right. Right. And that's 722,500 days. If you break it down, you get the five, which points to the atonement, and it's going right from the cross when Christ is demonstrating what he had done from the foundation of the world and atoning for the sins of his people. 10 is completeness, and then it's the completeness of God's salvation plan, because it goes right to judgment day from the cross. And then 17 is the number of God's blessing or heaven for his people. And that's what's going to happen on May 21. It's the rapture. It's the day of the resurrection. And so God doubled it. He doubled it. 5 times 10 times 17. There's another thing that relates to what Al is saying too in Daniel chapter 5. When King Belshazzar saw the writing on the wall. Remember the writing on the wall? Daniel was called to interpret. And in Daniel 5:25, it says, and this is the writing that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. So mene is doubled. And that means, that's a word for a number. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God has numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, they are weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck, and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. God doubled Mene. He said it twice. And in that night, let's see, what is said in Genesis? It is established by God and will shortly come to pass. And this is a picture of Judgment Day, because it's the end of the 70 years. The Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon. And what were the Babylonians doing? Eating and drinking and having a party. That's why the writing came on the wall, because they were using the vessels and they were using the cups and where does it say that? Oh, and verse 3, then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple, the house of God, which were at Jerusalem, and drank in them. Verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Eating and drinking, that's what Jesus says will be the case when he comes. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall be also in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. It says of Sodom, they were building and planning. And life is normal. And here is King Belshazzar in the 70th year from 609 to 539. We know it's right then, because the Medes and the Persians take the kingdom that night. In the night, it says, that night, Christ comes as a thief in the night. Well, where were their watchmen? Where were their guards? Shouldn't they have seen this? Probably a great army of the Medes and the Persians approaching. We don't get any indication they knew anything about it. They weren't they weren't prepared for battle at all. They were having a party, and the king was with them. And the only thing that bothered him was this writing. And then the interpretation that Daniel gave was, your kingdom is found wanting, and will be given to the Medes and the Persians, and it'll be the end. And did King Belshazzar understand? Somewhat. He understood that was the writing on the wall, just the interpretation. But we realize he didn't get it, because he tries to make Daniel the third ruler in the kingdom. Of what value is that? What value is that when the kingdom ends in a few hours? And so I think there we have a historical example of what is going to happen on May 21. All kinds of people are not going to get it. They're not going to see it. Christ will come as a thief in the night. But you notice one other thing about Daniel. When he showed up, when he was called and he showed up, he did not seek information from God. It's like he knew already. Do you recall that? Remember earlier when Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and he was ready to kill all the wise men of Babylon? And did Daniel know immediately what his dream was? He didn't know. He asked for time so he can go to the Lord, and him and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did, and they besought the Lord. Oh Lord. I mean, they not only had to interpret the dream, they had to find out what the dream was. Similar to Belshazzar. And yet it required time, and it required beseeching the Lord. When Belshazzar had Daniel come before him, if you look at in verse 13, was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet, and have a chain of gold about thy neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation. And he goes right into it, and he tells him, here's the writing, here's the interpretation. How did he know? It seems Daniel had some knowledge prior to this time that the kingdom of Babylon would be destroyed, because he's not going in prayer, he's not beseeching the Lord, he's not saying to the king, give me some time. He knows. And in that night, the king of the Medes and the Persians comes. It says in verse 30, in that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And remember how God speaks of this king? He's also known as Cyrus in the Bible, and God calls him Cyrus my anointed, which is the word Messiah that is in Daniel 9. Cyrus my shepherd. Christ came in the night is what it's pointing to, and he took Babylon. As well, yeah, the churches are Babylon, but the whole world is under the rule of Satan, and in that sense is Babylon. And so here, once again, we see that the child of God was fully prepared. Daniel, the Lord God will do nothing, but he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. Daniel goes right into the explanation, And no thanks, no thanks. Keep your gifts to yourself. It's kind of like today, you know. We know the world has no value. The knowledge of Judgment Day has devalued really everything. And for the believer who can see these things, and we don't need anything in the world. We don't need the things of the world. We never did, but now how much more let the world keep them, and we should not envy people of the world the things they have. Remember that Psalm 73? I saw the prosperity of the wicked, and I was envious. And it's a true child of God that's speaking. I was envious until I went into the sanctuary of the Lord, then understood I therein. And that knowledge of Judgment Day should completely remove envy. Why would we ever envy a person what this inheritance? This is it for them. This is all they're going to get. This is all the good things they're ever going to have. Why would we ever envy them, their houses or cars or money or whatever? Well, you know, may you enjoy it. Really, sincerely, may you enjoy it. But what the thing about pleasure and enjoying things in this world is it doesn't mean anything in the long run. You know, you can have a blast today. And tomorrow, you can't live off that. It's even short term here. But, of course, since the pleasures of the world are very temporal, then they're vanity. They're empty. Well, thank you for bringing up that question. Let's go to Pal Talk.
Okay. The question from Pal Talk is, read John 19:30.
John 19, verse 30?
Yeah.
Says, when Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, "It is finished." And he bowed his head and gave up the ghost.
The question is, what was finished? The demonstration?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that God had Christ come and to really live out what he had already done from the foundation of the world. Now, look at Hebrews 4, and it says in verse 3, "For we which have believed do enter into rest as he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world." So these works are referring to Christ making payment for sin. And all that was necessary for the salvation of God's people was done. It was accomplished. Before the world began, he was a lamb slain. And yet, there needed to be a demonstration in order to show man what he had done, in order to shine light on it. You know, the Bible says that Jesus is the light of the world. The Bible also says whatsoever does make manifest is light. And that's that same word, demonstrate, make manifest. Whatsoever does make manifest is light. He came as the light to make manifest what had already been accomplished, the works that were finished before this world began. And so, yet there was still some things to do. Remember at the cross is when Satan is cast down. So that still had to be done. That still had to be finished in that sense, so it could apply to that, because Satan was active and he was the ruler of this world. He had deceived man into sinning against God and bringing upon mankind death, and so the Bible said he had power over death. But then Christ came And he died and rose again, demonstrating that he now was the victor over death. Mr. Camping recently did a study pointing out how the many bodies of the saints which arose after his resurrection was a declaration of the victory of Christ over death, removing that power from Satan in the sense that he had won it back in the garden. And that's how Satan was cast out of heaven onto the earth, and he was bound, and all that language ties in to the cross. And so those things had to be completed too. Yes, Joe.
Hi, Chris. This is in response to that last question. I believe somebody brought it up on the open forum that those two Greek words for finished mm-hmm. are different Greek words.
Than what I read in Hebrews?
No, the two actual Greek words are different. They're both translated as finished.
Well, that's what I mean. You're talking about John 19:30 compared to
Correct.
Hebrews.
Correct, yes. But I guess it's not significant. Do you not think it's significant?
No, I would never say it's not
right.
significant.
I wouldn't either, but I'm saying as far as the idea you just put forth, I believe what you just said is quite correct.
I'm not prepared to answer that because I did not, you know.
I don't think anybody.
I haven't looked at the Greek, so I'm not prepared to answer it.
Okay, thank you.
But I will. Thank you. Lester. Deuteronomy
28 for a long time, you know, and because I know this is talking about the judgment to come and everything, you know, so I was going to read down to that, you know.
All right, Lester. Deuteronomy 28, if you were to map it out, the first 14 verses, God speaks of the blessings that come for obedience. And then 15 until the end, he speaks of the curses that come upon the disobedient. And this is all part of that. It's language of the wrath of God. For instance, verse 64, "And Jehovah shall scatter thee among all people from one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations thou shalt find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest, but Jehovah shall give thee there a trembling heart and failing of eyes and sorrow of mind." Now, God's speaking to Israel, and Israel was scattered by the tribes in the north by the Assyrians, the tribe Judah in the south by the Babylonians. And so we can see how this has application historically to that, but spiritually that teaches us about God's judgment on the churches and congregations, and why is the church under the judgment of God today? Why is judgment begun at the house of God? Disobedience with the high places, disobedience with their false teachings of what God is saying in His Word. And then it goes on to say in verse 68, "And Jehovah shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships. By the way whereof I spake unto thee, thou shalt see it no more again. And there ye shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen and bondwomen, and no man shall buy you or redeem you." The man is Christ. The man is Christ. And when the disobedient are brought back to Egypt in ships. And remember, Egypt was a place of bondage, the house of bondage where they were slaves. God will not redeem them. He'll not deliver them ever again. And the key here is understanding what Egypt represents. And in Revelation 11, God speaks of the two witnesses lying dead in the street, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt. And both Sodom and Egypt are types and figures of the church. And the church has been returned today into Egypt because God, the Holy Spirit, came out of the midst and Satan took his seat. There's Pharaoh on the throne. And when Christ left the church, deliverance left with him. Redeeming sinners left with him. And it leaves men in spiritual bondage. They're taken captive by Satan at his will, is the idea. And remember ships. God uses ships to typify the churches and congregations. So the Israelites, the disobedient Israelites, are taken back to Egypt in ships. It never happened historically. It never happened. Judah, or the remnant from Jerusalem, at the end, fled into Egypt, but we don't find any language of ships, because Israel wasn't far geographically from Egypt. They just went down and they entered into Egypt, but not with ships. And this means that that God has a spiritual meaning in view, and that is that the ships represent the churches and congregations. Remember, what is it that steers a ship? The small helm. As God mentions that in James, you know, the tongue is a little member, and he likens the tongue to the bridle on the horse's mouth and the helm of a ship. Who steers the ship? The preachers, the pastors, the priests. They teach the congregation. Oh, well, God, the gates of hell will never prevail against God's church. Oh, no, don't listen to anybody who says the church age is over, not understanding that church is the eternal church made up of God's elect and not the outward physical churches of all the denominations. And so they're telling the congregation, follow me. Follow me. We'll steer the course to heaven. And the ship is just going right back to Egypt, and it's taken them all into slavery, into spiritual bondage, and no man will redeem them. Christ will not buy them out. No one can become saved in the churches. That's what that's saying. Yes, Bob.
Another one from Pal Talk. What is the difference in meaning between the number 12 and 13? I've always, in my notes, I've had it as 12 is fullness and 13 is super fullness.
Well, number 13, unlike number 12, I think they can be similar. But number 13, we know relates to the end of the world. We know that. And 12 does, in a sense. Remember, there is 11,000 years of history until the coming of Christ, and 11,000 plus a few years. And then Christ, when he went to the cross, Satan was bound for 1,000 years. And that's just figurative up until, it was actually 1,955 years. But in that sense, God looks at the history of the earth as being about 12,000, because when Satan was loose from that binding, it was the 13,000th year of history in 1988. But if you look at it that way, 11,000 years and then 1,000 years of binding, God relates that to 12, even though it's actually 13. And that could tie in to the number of the tribes of Israel. How many tribes were there? 12, but actually 13. How many apostles were there? 12, but actually 13, because the Apostle Paul indicates he was an apostle. So, yeah, God does connect 12 and 13, but he uses 13 much more in relationship to the end of the world. Like Jacob was 130, 10 times 13 when he went into Egypt. Jehoiada the priest was 130 when he died, and then King Joash went astray, and many, many things. King Josiah was 39 when he died, 3 times 13, and that was in 609, beginning that 70-year period that typifies the Great Tribulation. So that would be, I think, a difference. God uses the number 12 a lot in Revelation chapter 21. It says in verse 12, and Revelation chapter 21, verse 12, and had a wall great and high, and had 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. And this is the fullness of the people of God, the 12 tribes, the 12 apostles, and now God is speaking of that heavenly Jerusalem, the bride of Christ. This is all the believers in view, all of God's elect. And by the way, look how God can break up the number 12. You know, as we break down numbers, and some people wonder, well, where do you get biblical justification for that? Well, God just went 12, 12, 12, 12, and then verse 13, on the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. 12 times 4, or 4 times 3 is 12. And again, the number 12 is in view. Further on, he multiplies. In verse 17, he measured the wall thereof 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. 12 times 12. So the essence of the number, fullness, it doesn't lose its value. 3 times 4, you could break it down and get a little bit more information. 12 times 12 is 144. And, you know, people charge that all the time, and they hear the infallible proof that from the cross until May 21 is 722,500 days. I don't blame them for not remembering the numbers, because you know I couldn't. And that is what? 5 times 10 times 17 times 5 times 10 times 17. And each number has spiritual significance, and God here shows us that breaking down numbers or multiplying numbers are fine. And by the way, I don't normally refer to theologians, but A.W. Pink, who's heard of him? A theologian, pretty good theologian, from the early 20th century. A.W. Pink did a study on Exodus where there was much numbers in view. And I could provide this for anyone. What he did was he saw numbers like 3 and 10, and he started saying the number 3 means this, the number 10 means that. And this is back 60, 70 years ago. And I'm sure it didn't originate with him, that God has led his people into various truths in history, not full and complete truth like we have today. They saw through a glass darkly, but various truths. And one of them was that it is biblical to break down numbers. And A.W. Pink, who many in the Reformed community really highly respect, broke them down when Mr. Camping would have been a young lad, just a young little boy. So it's not that this is Mr. Camping's methodology, but the only thing was that some of the numbers were off as far as their meaning, their application. Or he had some of them correct, some of them were similar to our understanding, some were off. And as you may have noticed over the years, Mr. Camping has also refined what the spiritual meaning is of a particular number as you study it more, you look at it more. But the main idea of looking for spiritual truth in breaking down numbers is older than family radio. Okay, time for one last one. Morning.
Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11.
1 Corinthians 11.
18 and 19.
Okay, for first of all, When you come together in the church, I hear that there be divisions among you, and I partly believe it. For there must be also heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest among you.
I've heard some of the church people would use that to say that there are always going to be division in the churches, and that Christ would never leave the churches. So would this scripture here bear that out, what they're saying there?
No. That's not so. That, no. Well, it is when you come together in the church. Now, God is speaking of the church in Corinth, but there's no way anyone could use these verses to show that God couldn't end the church age. Actually, the more likely verse, or at least more likely than those verses, is a little later in this same chapter, where it says, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you do show the Lord's death till he come. Wherefore, whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord." So here, people have tried to use the same kind of reasoning and say, see, God gives us a commandment. We have to maintain the Lord's table till he come. Therefore, you can't say the church age is over. You can't say that. We have to be faithful and keep the Lord's table going. Now, incredibly, they're suddenly concerned about being faithful to a command of the Bible, when the problem is there are so many commands that the church is unfaithful to. And so for them to make an argument, well, God can't judge us because he gave this commandment and he expects us to obey that commandment and maintain the Lord's table, would be similar to Judah saying to God, Lord, you can't bring the Babylonians upon us. After all, you gave us commands about keeping the light always burning in the temple with the candlesticks. You gave us commands concerning the sacrifices, that they had to be offered day and night, continuously, and many other commands. Yet, what's the problem? Well, the problem is when a disobedient people, they are disobedient on many levels and many points, that they think that because God gave a command that they were to obey, just like all the other commands that they're not obeying, that can spare them judgment. And God has shown no, because he told them to go in through Jeremiah, go into captivity, and he raised up the Babylonians to destroy Judah, which they did. Remember what the Babylonians did to the temple. Remember what they did. They utterly destroyed the temple so there could be no more sacrifices. So the light of the candlestick could no longer burn. Well, according to the reasoning of individuals that bring up verses like this, that should have never happened. And yet God, he's not going to fall for an excuse like that. They're going to look and find a verse that God commanded me to obey. Don't even bother. Look, you're under the wrath of God due to the disobedience, and that supersedes everything. Regarding these ordinances and these ceremonial laws, no, I'm not going to hold back my wrath in order that you can keep a law like this. Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for sharing your questions and your comments. And at this time, we're going to pray and take a break till 11:30. Let's have a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father,